This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations Religion and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio and transcript will be available on our website, CFR.org, and our iTunes podcast channel, Religion and Foreign Policy. We're delighted to have Gail Lamont with us today to talk about the humanitarian crisis and conflict in Syria. Gail Lamont is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations for the Women in Foreign Policy Program. She is the author of Ashley's War and the dressmaker of Tare Khanna, which are both New York Times bestsellers. She is currently a contributor to Atlantic's Defense One site, writing on national security and foreign policy issues, and a former contributing editor at Newsweek Daily Beast. She recently returned from Syria, a visit which culminated in a three-part PBS NewsHour series, and we sent out a link to that series in advance. So if you haven't had time to watch it, I commend it all to you after the fact. Gail, thanks very much for being with us today. I thought you could just brief us on your recent trip to Raqqa and what you saw there and witnessed in the ongoing conflict in Syria and the humanitarian crisis that we're reading about.
Absolutely, and thank you to all of you. As Irina mentioned, I am just back from northern Syria, and the one affiliation we didn't mention is I'm also a CNN contributor. So I'm working right now on a piece that should go up next week for CNN.com. I do a weekly column there about this lost generation of Syrian girls lost to this war, whose futures have been really sacrificed to this war. We went to Syria to do three pieces for PBS, and then I've done some print pieces for Defense One, and this will be for CNN afterward. And really what we wanted to do is to take viewers into the on-the-ground view of what was happening in Syria, because war is deeply personal, even if we don't talk about it enough that way. And the Syrian conflict is not just nameless, faceless people shooting at nameless, faceless people. There's just, you know, these incredible stories of moms and dads and young people who are really battling against the odds to have some kind of future. So we did three pieces. The first was on Raqqa and the fight for Raqqa. And for those of you who are following the Syrian conflict, which I know is not too many people, but if you're on this call, perhaps you are among the few, and it was really about the fight for the last, for what was the capital of the so-called caliphate and that fight and what that fight looks like. So we went to watch trainees being trained by the U.S. Special Operations Forces. And those they are training, mostly those they are training now, and recruits who are spending 2 weeks in basic training and then going to the front lines. And then we spent time with at a graduation of the Raqqa Internal Security Forces, which is the hold force, these young, mostly men that we met. There are some women in the force who are going to take the, who are holding the city once the Syrian Democratic Forces, who the Americans are backing, defeat. You know, take that territory, the security forces come in afterwards. And then we went to Ayin Nisa IDP camp, which is 7,000 strong of people who have been internally displaced by this battle and who have fled Raqqa. And the stories just, honestly, they take your heart out. You know, there's a mother we interviewed who's in the stories who left the city 8 months pregnant, led her two-year-old and her mentally ill husband out of the city amid ISIS reprisals. They had snipers killing anybody who tried to flee, and they also were very willing to kill people who were trying to escape, and coalition airstrikes, which were falling from the sky and killing people trying with because ISIS is using them as human shields. So this mother braved all of that to get to this displaced camp, and she gave birth in the IDP camp to a two-kilo baby, a teeny, tiny, tiny little thing. And, you know, she was so powerful and eloquent. Just like we kept calling her our Virgin Mary. You know, she was just talking to us about, in this very direct, very strong language, about what she hoped for her daughter's future, what she thought this next generation deserved, We asked her, what do you think of the airstrikes? And she said, you have to do whatever is required to get rid of these criminals and what she wanted for the future. We also met a mother who was leading her 20-person strong extended family out of Raqqa to the town of Tabqa, and they were genuinely living in rubble, in a bombed-out building where the smell of flesh kind of greets you as you walk in. And then you walk into what they have made their home, right? You know, there are a lot of families living there who've been displaced from fighting wherever else. And they have, the women are washing, everybody is clean, everybody has clean clothing, they're doing their best they can. The men are trying to go, you know, basically sift through the rubble and find what they can that could be sold, metal or scrap. And everybody is trying to get by. And there I met a 16-year-old who will be in the CNN piece, who was finished grade 9. And then, like all of the girls she knew, you know, she said once the war started, everyone was either kidnapped, had something awful criminally happen to them, or their parents sold them into marriage. And I don't mean sold them like slavery. I mean their parents basically found husbands for them because it was the only way these parents thought they had to keep their kids safe. And she said, you know, I used to dream of being a flight attendant, and now all my dreams are for my children, because she's 16 with a 2-year-old and a 9-month-old. And she said, and I'm one of the lucky ones because my husband, I actually like my husband. So you see desperation and heartbreak, but you also see people really determined to push forward. And the eeriest thing, which I'll leave you with, is that to hear 19 and 20-year-olds talk to you about how everything they're doing is for the next generation. They don't care about their generation anymore. Their generation has no future, but it's all for the next one.
Thank you. We can open up to questions and comments from the group.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key, followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And our first question comes from Yuri Mantilla with Liberty University.
Yes, well, thank you very much for that report regarding the Syrian conflict, Professor Yuri Mantilla. Considering that there are crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes taking place in Syria, and that those crimes or international crimes are mainly targeting, you mentioned, children, how do you see the international community taking action in the Syrian conflict? When I talk about international community, I'm not only focusing on Western European countries, the United States, Russia, but also developing countries. What would be the place to get countries, you know, in Asia, in Latin America, all over the world? How can we mobilize the international community to take action?
I think this is a conflict that has gone on so long and with so little actual humanitarian work that everybody has gotten used to this. And that is, to me, a huge danger because there is so much more the world could do. First of all, the international community could push very hard for education. There are too many kids out of school. INISA IDP camp has no education system at all whatsoever. I mean, just basic literacy 101 for all those little people, and it breaks your heart. That should not be. In my view, we could do better. And the thing is, there are so many sensitivities among Syria, the Syrian regime, and Turkey, and Russia, and the United States, and we haven't even, you know, gotten to, Assad's likely state. But none of that matters to these little ones, right? I mean, to me, it's like there has to be some level of understanding that literacy and basic skills should be at every place for the displaced. And the Americans have been very reluctant to send aid to northern Syria in large doses because they're not sure about that they fully vetted the Syrian Kurd civil councils yet, which also have strong Arab representation. I think that's very important to know. We can get into the politics of it if you want, but that took us another 10 minutes.
Yes, yes.
And But the world could do much more, first of all, on the education front. And I truly believe that more could be done if more NGOs were sort of committed to that with support from the international community. Second of all, I think there has been no sense that the world is actually clamoring for justice and a war crimes tribunal or anything even resembling responsibility being taken for who has done what. It's very hard to get to sites to inspect. Amnesty, Human Rights Watch have done reports, but, you know, I do think those are worth doing and more. But to me, the biggest question is how do you get to the next generation and get them educated, because it's what every parent talks to you about.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Marina Kaliamiko with St. Albans Parish.
Into my question. This is Marina Villarico, St. Albans Parish, Washington, D.C. We support a school right on the edge of Syria in Jordan, and it does educate some of the refugees from the camp there. And I think education in Zarqa. Okay, and I was wondering, you know, what groups do you know of who are organizing to get at the educational needs of those people? Anybody? Are there any groups anywhere in the world that are beginning to organize efforts to try to educate either this current generation or the next generation?
It's a really good question. There are very many local folks who have been focused on it. U.S. Department of State has the START program, but quite honestly, I think they have 7 or 8 people who are doing the best they can, but how much can 7 or 8 people do? The Mercy Corps and the IRC, and in full disclosure, I'm on Mercy Corps' board, but I also know IRC is there, and NGOs are starting to come in. I actually think a pressure point would be to go to the NGOs and say, you know, who can we deal with on the ground to help get resources to educate children? UNICEF is there, too, but I've not seen schooling be a priority there. There's so much else emergency-wise, and that could have changed. But I do think that the NGOs could have more pressure brought under them, more donors saying, here's what we want to give to, that would be very useful. That is my personal view.
Yeah, you have a real ally in the Georgian ambassador here in Washington about the fact that with refugees, the education issue is just not raised and needs to be. And she's very outspoken on that. Yeah.
And I have been thinking, you know, since I got back, like, why is there no education? Why is there, you know, these kids in INESA IDP camp, just to tell you. You know, I met a 13-year-old girl who's been out of school for 5 years. And when ISIS came, obviously all of that ended, all the education she had. And I asked her, you know, what do you want to do? She said, my only dream is to be back in school. And I said, what's your favorite subject? She said, oh, I don't care. You know, whatever subject would be fine if we could be in a classroom. And at the end, I was asking her questions, and she'll be in this piece, too. And this is what stayed with me. I said, well, you know, I really wish I could spend more time with you. And she said, you looked at me and said, I wish you could be here every day. Because think of when the last time any of these kids have had anybody ask them how they were. What they
what the Jordanian ambassador talks about is that people have to recognize if you don't educate this generation, they just go to become terrorists, and that's where it is.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, I'd be happy to continue this conversation offline. Arena can arrange it. I have been in meetings with the Jordanian ambassador. I haven't met her. I really, truly believe there is more to be done on this. And I may be going back to the region if I do a book that is related to that. That's a whole other story for another day. But, you know, I would definitely want to go back and see those kids there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Aristotle Papanikolaou with Fordham University.
Hi there. I was just wondering, in your time there, whether you shed some light, a little bit on sort of how the Christian perspective is, because, you know, we hear, of course, about Christian persecution within the Syrian conflict, and amidst much of the other suffering as well, but also I saw pictures of Christians with Assad in some kind of official ceremony of some sort where Assad is speaking. But I didn't know whether in your time there, whether you sort of encountered that and whether you can shed some light on that for us.
It's an interesting question. Honestly, we were much more focused on Kurds versus Arabs in northern Syria and the U.S. effort to try to figure out if it can get behind. And I did a piece actually about the U.S. Special Operations being, you know, their biggest concern is that the U.S. is going to abandon Syria's Kurds. And they will say it in no uncertain terms. And that piece, you know, for those of you who are interested, I know Arena has it. It got a lot of attention within national security circles because that is a, you know, it's very clear that Special Operations feels like the Syrian Kurds, as much as Turkey sees them very differently, are allies and true allies with whom they could get behind and fight alongside. But the Christian question came up several times in terms of just the minority piece. But everybody, it didn't come up first and foremost, but I've read a great deal about it. And I do think that the question of minorities and how they have been treated and whether some will stay with Assad because it's what you know versus the uncertainty of persecution if you don't, is very much a question that is in play. And I think there's real fear about what might come next for different groups, both if Assad goes and if Assad stays.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Ann Rogers with the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh.
Hi. My question is partly a follow-up on the last question, and then there's a second part to it. What we've heard, not so much coming out of Syria, but out of Iraq and some other contexts, is that Christians are often afraid to go to the refugee camps for fear that they will be persecuted within the refugee camps, and that's an issue. So it sounded like you had met Christians in the refugee camps, and I wondered if you could just comment on whether there was tension there. And then the other part of my question is, like, what, you know, typical Americans can do to try to bring some kind of help or comfort to the situation. I think people read about it and they're just overwhelmed.
I agree with that entirely. So I did not meet Christians in the camp, but I did talk to folks in northern Iraq who had camps where Christians were present. And that is very true. I did not hear that they were persecuted in the camps, but I definitely did hear that different groups were worried about interaction with different groups in the camps. Right? The camps are no security panacea by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, the Yazidis left one camp because too many Arabs were coming in. Right? So, I mean, from Mosul. So there's definitely, you hear stories about this. Now, I will say I'm very clear about what I saw and what I didn't. I did not see that myself, but I definitely talked to people I trusted who spoke with me about that. And so I do think that all minorities are facing a very tenuous situation right now. And the Christians, certainly among them, and I read a piece yesterday, actually, that was about this issue and whether Christianity would be erased, you know, and that was sort of one of those. And you know, I think if you talk to the Kurds, they try to go to very great pains to say, we are multi-ethnic here. Like, we want in northern Syria there to be Assyrians, Kurds, Arabs, you know, we all belong here. Some take issue with that, but that is definitely what you hear from people running civil councils and running the administration in northern Syria. And on this point about what people can do, I think that is such an important one. One, and I wish it were easier. I wish I had an easier answer. One is that I think people can give to local refugees, right? There are a number of churches that have been very active. And Jewish Catholic Relief Services, I think it's Jewish, the Jewish Relief Agency. Jewish Services, they've been active. And I think it really has been the religious community, the faith community, that has been the most welcoming from what I have seen in terms of Syrian refugees and the small number who made it to the U.S. I think that support is so very important as people land in a strange country with strange food, strange schools, a strange language, strange road system, right? I do think that matters a great deal. And the second thing I would say is to call your members of Congress, those calls actually do get logged, and tell them, you know, you want the U.S. to do more in northern Syria. You want more aid for northern Syria. And I only say northern Syria because that's where the Americans are most active, and it's what the State Department is evaluating right now. Should they give more? And then the third thing is to talk to NGOs. You know, it wouldn't have to be huge amounts of money, but you all command, you know, audiences who have some capital. It doesn't have to be huge. But bundle your donations and talk to NGOs about wanting to get earmarking those dollars for school issues, or, you know, for schools, either for refugees in Turkey and Jordan or for IDPs inside Syria. So you want it for education.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Elliot Asude with University of Nevada, Reno.
Hi, thank you so much for your wonderful and insightful report. So my question relates to the role of Iran and both for the Revolutionary Guard and their recruitment of children and teenagers, specifically the Afghan teenagers under the age of 18 through the guards of the Fatemiyun in a civil war in Syria. So is there any way that if be addressed by international community that why Iran using children and teenagers for the war, specifically recruiting them from the Afghan population that lives in Iran?
You know, this is a very real issue, and I have both books I did had been set in Afghanistan. Dressmaker of Fuck when I was about a teenage girl who supported her business under the supported her neighborhood under the Taliban in Afghanistan. So I read Tolo and a bunch of Afghan press, Pajwak, that's English language Afghan media, and that story about young people being recruited by Iranian forces. Or forced, however you want to look at it, if their parents would stay, they have to do whatever, is very real. I've been following that storyline for years. The Iranian influence from the geopolitical perspective, it's what the Americans are most worried about next, right? And I would urge the last point, as point of the last questioner, was saying, what could we do? I would deeply argue that we should stay engaged in Syria. Just because the fight in ISIS against ISIS is over does not mean you pack up and go home, in my view. Because ISIS 3.0 and 4.0 comes when there's alpha governance, the safe havens for malign actors, and no support from the international community for people on the ground who are doing the best they can to rebuild in a conflict that has become global, right? With Russia, Iran, Turkey, the U.S. all playing a role in that war. So I would strongly argue against just packing up and going home. I'm not ever arguing for 20,000 ground troops or anything like that, but the special operations support for the Syrian Democratic Forces has actually yielded a benefit. And in my view, to give space for civil society to come in and for services to slowly start returning. And I think it should be supported. And I would say that the Iranian influence shows no sign of waning as the Assad regime looks stronger and stronger. And there has not been enough at the UN to talk about the role of child soldiers and those who are recruited. And frankly, I wish there were more.
No, exactly. Thank you. And specifically, if we look at very recent articles that even Henry Kissinger wrote, about Iran's imperialistic ambition. I myself have written two pieces on Shia expansionism of Iran, because those places that used to be populated by Sunni groups or Sunni population in Syria, after the civil war get a little bit settled in those areas, now Revolutionary Guard, specifically Gulf Force, is populating, importing Shia population from neighboring countries to put in those areas. So they are basically doing what Stalin at some point did with Georgia. So,
And I will say just one final thought before we take the next question is that, A, thank you for that, but B, you talk to American policymakers about what they worry about next post-Syria, it is the rising influence of Iran. Absolutely. That's the immediate response you will get.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Shaikh Ubed with Muslim Peace Coalition.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I'm Sheikh Ubaid with Muslim Peace Coalition and also Burma Task Force. You know, the longest running genocide in the world is happening in Burma, Rohingyas, which is not as much in the news as the unfortunate people of Syria. I'm going to ask you, how do we mobilize the faith leaders in the U.S. To counter the propaganda about not accepting refugees and not getting involved and not donating more, and how to fight this perception? For example, you know, people, faith leaders here are more focused on the minorities, for example, in Syria, which they should be, but at the same time, the largest group, the Sunnis, are the one who are bearing the brunt of the regime's atrocities. So how do we rise above the sectarian, you know, interest and help everybody who is suffering there? To buy into the propaganda of the monarchies, the corrupt leaders who say that if we do not educate them, they will become terrorists, presumes that Muslims, for example, are more inclined towards terrorism. You know, there are terrorists who are very well educated, and you know, and they use their education to take revenge or to fight for their causes. So, education is, you know, is not the lack of education is not the reason for terrorism. It's the persecution that is, and displacement of people that is. So, but how do we mobilize the powerful faith leaders in the U.S. To help the country become more acceptable to helping the refugees, not only in Syria but also in Burma, which is the longest running genocide.
So I appreciate your question. I agree with you on education, and I certainly don't think anybody was saying only Muslim children would become terrorists. But if you only see war for a great deal of time, and the most attractive options are presented to you by malign actors, it's just understandable. I think that education has its own benefits, and I mostly see it as leading to economic growth and stability, which breeds more security. Right, and in more equitable society, which is why I think it matters a very great deal. And I would say that probably most people on this call would certainly agree with that. And to your point about faith leaders, I think that the folks on this call have not fully recognized how much power they have, because the military is one trusted institution, and I still think that faith communities are about the only thing that people trust in their societies right now. And I believe truly that if faith leaders spoke out more on the weekends and with their followers about why refugees matter and how each one of us, you know, there but for the grace of God, go every single one of us, and that, you know, it is not okay to demonize an entire faith, but that, you know, there is a reason why the United States has been, in my view, as it is, which is because we are an accepting nation that does not create values of who is an American and who isn't. It is what's special. Listen, my father was an Iraqi refugee when he was a kid, and it shaped everything that came for him afterward. You go to Europe. If I were in Europe, I would have to put a picture on my CV and tell everybody where my father had come from every time I applied for a job. That is not America. It's what America is, makes America so very special, and it's why I feel so deeply patriotic about this country. But I do think the language of patriotism and the language of what makes America special has to be taken back. And I do think the space community could do much more to explain in conjunction with the military, which, by the way, national security leaders have been the most clear about why, you know, these bans were not in anybody's interest, certainly not in American national security interest, and have been the most ardent in fighting for their battlefield buddies in Afghanistan and Iraq to come to the U.S. No one's arguing for not extreme vetting. absolutely everybody wants to know who's coming. But if you follow the process of what it takes to be a refugee, come to the United States, you will know how painful that process is. So I think you can argue for strong vetting and a strong America that is inclusive and full and lives up to the ideals of this nation. And I think faith communities could do more.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Eleanor Ellsworth with Episcopal Diocese.
Hi, I'm Eleanor from San Diego. And as you may or may not know, there are many, many, many refugees here and that go on here. But my question takes us back to your emphasis on literacy in Syria for the children. Here's my remembrance. There was an awful lot of activity in Afghanistan organized by Rotary International. And I was wondering if you've had any sampling of activity from Rotary, and if not, my second question would be, is there a contact point that would be best so that Rotary could be influenced, and I am a Rotarian, I think lots of people are, to do something in Syria, such as we have done in Afghanistan?
That is an excellent question, and I have not across, you know, honestly, Syria has been no man's land in terms of the international community for a great deal of time. And by the way, the UN won't even deliver to areas that are not regime held most of the time. I mean, it has been a disaster of epic proportions on the humanitarian scale. And
wow.
I would say that there is room now. Mercy Corps is coming back in. You know, I mean, and for very good reason, right? People didn't want to put their own people at risk. Who controls what areas? You know, Syrians have been risking their lives for all of these local and international NGOs. A great deal. And more could be done. Arwa Damon from CNN actually has an NGO, Inara, that is working with Syrian kids. But I would love to know if Rotary were there. And I did not see any sign that it was. I'd be very surprised if they were, given how sliced up the country's areas are and how ongoing the fight is. But there are areas of, I don't want to put anybody at risk, but there are areas of Syria that, that really do feel quite fine. And we're going back to Hafez, you know, which was under ISIS occupation as recently as May. Kids just went back to school, which is an amazing thing. It's one of the best sites in the whole world. To see little ones with backpacks. And,
yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, we interviewed Syrian refugees in Turkey, and there was one little girl in the family of seven kids who got to go to school. And the difference in watching her bound home with her backpack and watching all the other little kids in the street, no place to go every day. I will never forget it. It stays with you. That purpose, that focus, that direction of those children. It matters a great deal, so I would love to know if Rotary were there, and I do think there would be a way for them to do more.
Well, I can follow up with Rotary International and find that out. But
that would be great.
The question would simply be, what would be the starting point from inside Syria, I suppose, is the word.
Yeah, I think the question then would be, is it a local NGO or is it an international NGO that, you know, where you could, if you're American, go to the headquarters and say, here's what we would like to do. Can we partner with you? Tell us, you know, they've all mapped this groundwork, right? And they are also working with the local civil councils because it's very important to work with the infrastructure that people from there are building. And they are building it, right? I mean, they want their kids to go to school more than everybody else does, right?
Sure.
So I would say that there are local folks, actors on the ground who want the same thing but could really use the resources. And I do think thinking of the international NGOs like Mercy Corps, IRC, which I know are in the country, and working in touch with the civil councils could actually be a decent starting point.
Great. That's wonderful. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to help with the connectivity.
Thank you.
Next question. And our next question comes from Soraya Dean with Muslim Women Speakers.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you. So my question is, I strongly believe a mother's heart is a child's classroom. And I'm curious to know how the mothers are nourishing their children at this time. How are they building on hope? And what are they telling their children about their predicament?
So it's interesting. I mean, I'll be honest with you. The mothers can tell their children what they want, but those children, unless they are unable to speak, are more observant than anybody else, right? I mean, they see everything that's happening. And these kids are so tough, and they're so strong, and they are so desperate to be back in school. And I think we cannot underestimate the help that these children saw. You know, we did a story, if you want to see, from Manbij, we did a story about a town at 1 year on after ISIS occupation. And this dad was just incredible. He was painting the wall blue and his gate pink and green because he said, you know, and and this whole street was only rubble. And then we see this guy who has painted his house. And so we stopped and asked him, you know, what's going on? Why are you doing this? And he said, you know, I'm just so happy to have my life back, to have my children back, to have life without ISIS back. And he said, I'll do anything for today. And my children saw beheadings. My children saw people hanging from the corners. And, you know, all these kids are out in the street. We're trying to do this TV shoot. And there are probably 60 kids from the whole neighborhood. So you can imagine the rambunctiousness. And it was so fun and so crazy. It's so impossible to actually shoot television. But really funny. We made the 10 and 12-year-olds our security perimeter so that nobody could get in our shot. But, you know, you see all of these parents who are just trying to put their lives together for children who have seen more than any child should see in a lifetime in just a few years. And so their parents can tell them whatever they want, but these children have seen it all themselves. No matter what their parents have tried to protect them from, these children have seen it. You know kids, right? They see everything. They're so much smarter than adults ever give them credit for. So I think what you see now are all these mothers who said that they will risk anything, like the woman who walked out of Raqqa 8 months pregnant, to give their kids a better future. And all they care about is their children's future. And one 19-year-old young man we interviewed, actually whose brother at 15 had died fighting ISIS, he said, you know, I don't care. He said, my generation is illiterate. We have no future. But all we're fighting for is for kids.
Thank you.
Absolutely. But I would say that, one last point on that. We did this first piece from Raqqa, and we were joking that we had to add some men because the mothers were so powerful in the piece that the three mothers told the story of Syria. So if you have a moment to watch that, I think that will answer some of your question too.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Khosrow Merfar with Fazana.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for your informative and a very caring presentation. My question deals with UN, and it has two parts to it. I may have received the answer to the first part, but nevertheless, I ask you. We all know that the major portion of the budget for UN is coming from U.S. So can you please elaborate on the role of UN, specifically on the fundamental principle of education? That's the most important critical, in my opinion, to, as you mentioned several times, that's absolutely true. So what do you think UN can do or is doing focused laser sharp on education, especially the really kids from the young age? And the second part of my question is, not only this, but looks like many other conflicts all around the world have something to do with religion, and it's been proven. I know in the charter of UN, it's not there yet. Maybe at the time that it was created, there was no need. But what do you think about the possibility of something like, for the lack of a better word, let's call it the religious arm, the United Nations. So UN can get in touch with the religious leaders, specifically in the locality of the areas. And then, you know, they can educate the local people and so forth. Thank you.
I do think that, so the UN has been there, they have stayed in Syria and, you know, to help people, but that also means that they have been subject to the rules of the Syrian regime. I'm sure they would see it differently, but that is what folks on the ground told us, and that's what you think. UNICEF is active, very active. I don't know about the schooling, though. I have not seen any dollars go for actual schools, and I do think more could be done. But I do think UNICEF is active on the nutrition front, and certainly they've been active in Iraq. But you know, northern Syria has been a dynamic situation. And so I don't know. I know that they have been there. They are there, but I don't know to what dollar amount. You know, the UN has tried very hard on the peace deal side and gotten roughly nowhere because actors definitely feel like they have more to gain by continuing the fight than by ending it. And the regime, with the help of Russian air power and Iranian actors, has really been able to make gains since the Aleppo campaign. And so, to some extent, they haven't really felt the need to come to the table. I think the UN has to be more active in talking about the humanitarian catastrophe. It has to be more active in trying to push. But it's hard for the UN because it's a collection of member states. And look at the Security Council, right? And so it's very difficult for the UN as a whole. I do think that the new Secretary General is very committed because he worked so much on Syria in his previous role. To trying to work on the humanitarian catastrophe in Syria, but I do think the UN faces its own set of limitations.
Second part, if you don't mind, about the possibility of UN getting more involved in this religious activity and maybe even having a branch of the arm of the United Nations.
I think that given that it's a collection of member states, it would never fly. I love the idea.
For the UN to do what it's already not has on its plate, quite honestly.
And while I think that is a really interesting idea, I don't see it becoming actionable anytime soon. But I hope I'm wrong.
So you think it's a great idea, but very hard to think. That's correct.
I mean, I think the idea of trying to deal with extremism and try to get at, you know, of all branches, of all kinds, and to talk about, you know, to look at the role of faith and to try to work with religious leaders is something that has been done actually in Afghanistan. UN Women has done it actually in Afghanistan to get local clerics to sign on to family planning and, you know, into the country constitution and other kinds of things. So I think there's a role that's already being done. I don't know about breaking it out separately.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from David Wildman with the United Methodist Church.
Yes, thank you. And thank you especially for all the focus on children. I really appreciate that. My question is, I work across the street from the UN, so following up on the role of the UN, there have been a few sort of regional de-escalation zones where at
correct,
least there's,
yeah,
you know, a kind of modest political will on the part of the different actors. And I'm just wondering if your sense of, like, the impact of these de-escalation zones, especially on the children, in relation, as in contrast to the continues to be arms transfers. So the international community is, unfortunately, it seems to me, giving an awful lot of aid, but it's the wrong kind of aid in terms of arms from all sides kind of being pumped in there. So if you know, just sort of that, do these de-escalation zones create some space where education and the well-being of children can kind of be moved closer to front and center?
I don't think that they are unhelpful. I would say that it would have to be bigger. But I do think, look, I think Russia and the U.S., as much as the language gets heated, at this moment have really been using the deconfliction line and have been trying to stay out of each other's way. And I think the deconfliction zones, I'm sorry, the local peace deals, there's this limited peace agreements or at least ceasefires, and I shouldn't say peace agreements, have been, I think those are always a good, I don't think those are a bad thing. But if actors use them simply to regroup and rest up, then, you know, that is the question. They are too new, really, for me to give you a thoughtful and informed answer. But I do think that families are using the space, you know, and I think this brings the second point that's really important, is that Syrians want to go home. Ask any refugee or displaced person what they want, and the first thing they say is to go home and rebuild. And I do think there's going to be a lot of tension in that because, so for example, we interviewed a mother, she's in our piece about Manbij, who talked to, and her teenage son. And the mother said, our problem is not with the Kurds. Our problem is with fellow Arabs who think when we say we're from Raqqa, they say, oh, you're all terrorists. Why did you bring us ISIS? And we try to tell them, look, we didn't bring you ISIS, right? Like, we're here. And I asked his son, do you have a lot of friends who joined ISIS? And he said, absolutely. And I said, why didn't you? And he said, because my mother wouldn't let me.
Yeah, that's very hard if that's the only option that young men especially feel is, I think you said that earlier about pursuing armed actions.
And I do think education presents alternative. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Soraya Dean with Muslim Women Speakers.
Thank you for giving me the time for the second question. I work with the Omnia Institute for Contextual Leadership, where we deconstruct received theology. And what you just said was profound to me. How are the mosques? Are they operating? What is being taught? And how are they keeping the children away from being recruited?
I think that is it's a central question and one that I honestly and truly don't have a good answer for. I know people are praying. We saw people praying. And I do believe that that mosques are operational, particularly in places that are more secure for certain. I do not know what's being taught there, and I think it would be useful. Idlib right now is a town that is really under more or less al-Qaeda occupation. And to some extent, people were, I wouldn't say okay with it. It wasn't they were okay with al-Qaeda, but you know, the idea of these guys kind of running an administration and staying out of their way. But they can't even offer basic services. There's a great paper that, one of the think tanks just did about Idlib. It's either Middle East Institute, Washington Institute. I'm sorry, I can't remember. I've read so many of late. But one of them just did. That was about Idlib and about really the failure of the al-Qaeda-linked groups to deliver on basic services and losing the local population because of it. I do think that people want services. They want to send their kids to school. You hear that over and over again. They don't want their children recruited. But I don't know what the role of the mosque is there, and I'd be very interested to find out.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
At this time, we have no questions in the queue.
Gail, you say in your CBS NewsHour special, you mentioned that there are already signs of life in Raqqa. What stands out particularly hopeful?
The desire to return to life. I can't tell you how many people said to me, if we could push a button and return to 2010, we would. They are not fans of the regime, but they are exhausted by war and displacement, and they want something better for their children. You know, I dream of my children becoming a teacher. I dream of my children becoming an engineer. I heard that over and over again. And that's why I bring it up on this call, is because that's what you hear, is this desire. You know, we heard less desire for vengeance than I expected, quite honestly. And I do think in part it's because of the barbarism of ISIS in the areas. It's a whole new level of descent into hell that these folks have brought to communities. And people are very clear about that. And they really want something different. And that is what is, to me, powerful.
Great. Next question.
Our next question comes from Tamer Alray with Baruch College.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
Okay. I'm sorry. My question, I'm from Syria, by the way. My question is what's your prediction to the next near future, like next 3 years, what's going to happen in Syria?
If I could answer that properly, I would definitely have a crystal ball, but I will tell you three questions, and I would argue that you, they may, I'm sure you have a very informed and good perspective on but could you ask me for mine? I was, and I've been following the policy conversation. I would say this. We don't know, because one scenario has a peace deal eventually being brokered, and a lot of people talk about a loose federation. Northern Syria would say Northern Syria, you know, with the Kurds and Arabs together running the Syrian Democratic Project, and the SDF bringing some level of security, the regime having its space, and the Russians and the Iranians staying active in the regime's space, and everybody kind of living with one another in this loose federation. Another scenario has a peace deal where transition is discussed. I find that harder to believe. I do not think Assad feels anything but strengthened by what's been happening in the last 18 months. And I don't think that the Americans, who once had the policy of Assad must go, are serious about that. I really don't. I think that they are much more like, Assad can kind of stay, and we'll have our zone of influence here and in this new federation, and we will have these folks who we've been working with in this area, and the regime will kind of stay in this area, and we'll all fight extremism to the degree, but, you know, I don't see any, but there's not going to be a big transition at this moment. The third scenario is that the Americans just say, okay, we beat ISIS, thank you so much, Syrian Kurds and Arabs who fought with us. It's been, you know, this has been a very fruitful partnership. We appreciate it. Turkey then runs the regime comes back in, takes those areas back with the help of Russian air power and passive support from Turkey. And that whole democratic project goes away. We do not yet know the answer to which of those scenarios is going to play out. If you talk to the military folks in particular, they're very deeply believe that the U.S. should stay committed, which might surprise some people. It surprised me a little bit before I'd seen it in action. And they are very worried, both for American security and for America's credibility, that America will walk away. But the next question will be, under what auspices, under what pretext is America still there? What authorization? And this is a whole other CFR conversation about the authorization of the military force under which all of this is happening. So I think there are key questions that are going to get answers in the next 6 to 12 months, and they will shape what comes next.
I think we'll try to squeeze this one final question.
Okay.
Thank you. The last question we have is from Sheikh Obed with Muslim Peace Coalition. Sheikh, your line is live.
Did he drop off, or?
I'm showing he's still connected. Mr. Obeid, are you there?
Okay.
I'm getting no response, but he is still connected.
All right. I'm sorry that we're not able to connect with him. Gail, we're nearing the end of our time anyhow. Are there any final thoughts you want to leave us with?
I would just say that for me, this is all a security and stability question. I think it does affect America, whether we've covered this war like it does or not. And I do think that the thing that has stayed with me are the moms and the little ones who are just hungry for something better. And so for every time somebody says you can't do something, I hope you challenge that because there is something you can do. And I think, you know, what we tried to do is the best storytelling takes away the other. You know, it has a sort of de-otherization about it. And I hope with these stories we've been able to show you that these are moms and dads and little ones and young men and young women fighting who are just like the ones you know in your community. And they're fighting for their future.
Check. 1, 2. Gail, thank you very much for doing this and for everybody's terrific questions. And I hope that you will take Gail Max Lamont's words of the call to action to heart and take this message back to your communities because you all are faith leaders and can do a lot in your place, in your places where you are. So we hope that you will do that. It's always a pleasure to have you on, Gail. You can follow Gail Lamont on Twitter at Gail Lamont. We also encourage you to follow us on Twitter at CFR_religion for announcements about upcoming events and information about CFR resources. As always, we encourage you to send us feedback, speaker or topic suggestions. We'd love to consider those, and we look forward to your participation in future discussions. Thank you all.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at CFR.org.